It's 10 after 8. John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. This just in, we're electing a president this year. Oh, you noticed already. Okay, well then, you probably noticed that all of the candidates are talking about a variety of plans to either cut taxes, reduce spending, fix the deficit, help workers, increase funding for education, etc. When it comes to details, though, it can be tough to decode the messages. What do they all really mean? Well, help is on the way. There's a new book out titled Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. It has answers to life's persistent questions about the federal budget. And amazingly enough, we have convinced the authors of this book to spend this hour telling you about it and answering your federal budget questions. Scott Biddle is an award-winning journalist and executive editor of Public Agenda Online. And Gene Johnson is executive vice president and founder of Public Agenda Online and has written for dozens of publications, including Education Week and US Today, USA Today. They both join us by telephone. Good morning and welcome to you both.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Okay, well, we'll start out with the toss-up question, as they used to say on Password, which dates me terribly, I think. How aware is the average citizen when it comes to the federal to federal budget issues? And I don't care who goes first, but I suppose as a good host, I should pick somebody. Gene, why don't you take this one?
Well, you know, I think most Americans are vaguely aware that all is not right with the federal budget and that there's debt and there's red ink. But the problem is that it hasn't really become a high priority, and the majority of Americans don't know how serious the problem is down the road. And we're still in a situation where, you know, as you point out, we're sort of listening to these vagaries from the presidential candidates and later in the year with the candidates for the Senate and the House. And we're sort of buying this, that, you know, you can cut taxes and still have all the things that most Americans say they want, or that we can add all of these new programs without raising taxes. And, you know, the numbers just don't add up, and Americans need to come to grips with that.
Well, you can cut taxes and still give everybody what they want as long as you have a no-limit credit card.
Well, that's what they've been doing, and this has been the you know, the kind of the default course in Washington for 31 out of 35 years. So it's just routine in Washington to avoid any of the hard choices, any of the unpleasantness, by adding to the debt, rather than you know, speaking the less pleasant truth.
Well, Scott, I'm going to ask you this: how serious is are our budget issues, and why should we care?
Well, our budget issues are very serious, and the best way of telling that is everyone who looks at the federal budget, whether it's in government, out of government, liberal or conservative, the government's own auditing agencies, all use the same word to describe the long-term fiscal outlook, and the word is unsustainable. It just can't go on the way it has. Because we're going to have, in addition to the $9 trillion debt we've already built up, we have more than $50 trillion of liabilities ahead of us over the next few decades as we pay for Medicare and Social Security for the baby boomers. That's going to be potentially a huge drain on the economy and a huge drain on the federal budget. The Government Accountability Office estimates that if we don't do anything, if we ignore this problem totally, by 2040, every tax dollar the federal government has would get sucked up by Medicare, Social Security, and interest on the money we've already borrowed to keep things going. There wouldn't be any money for anything else.
And that assumes that we actually have an economy that has enough workers left in it to produce any taxes at all.
That's assuming a good economy. And, of course, if you have these kinds of liabilities weighing on you, there's a very good question whether you can have a good economy.
Well, I have to say that my wife and I had a discussion recently, and I determined that I will be better off if I just keep working until I'm 85. Are any of the presidential candidates giving indications that they understand and are willing to deal with the kinds of problems you talk about in your book?
I would say all the presidential candidates really are acting like they're not going to be living in an era of fiscal constraints, and the fact is they probably will be. You know, an election season is the promising season, and candidates are wont to promise a lot of new spending or tax cuts and not to talk about how to pay for them.
Gene, how did we get to this point?
Well, we got to it by it being, there's kind of it takes two to tango problem here. It is much easier for somebody who's in elected office to keep taxes low and provide everything that Americans want. They can add to the debt. They can, as they have, borrow out of the Social Security Trust Fund, and that's the easier path. And we've had a public, there's a portion of the public that's not paying much attention at all, and even Americans who do follow politics have sort of bought this line of, tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, which is fine if you're willing to shrink government to match it, but we aren't. We have to start being much more accountable. And I also blame the media. I think the media have not really, this is considered a boring topic, kind of a my eyes glaze over anytime we talk about fiscal responsibility in the budget. But it is not boring when you start looking at it and is extremely important, and it really could undercut our way of life.
I wouldn't ordinarily bring callers in this early, but Scott in Peshtigo has such a great question, I think, that I'm going to bring him on now. Scott, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I guess my question is it a tax issue or is it a spending issue? And my point for asking that is over the last 25 years, we have cut taxes, but receipts to the Treasury have grown dramatically. I mean, money is flush. Money is pouring into the federal government, yet our spending seems to be out of control. Whenever we get into this argument how we can't have tax cuts because we have to pay for certain things, I just think that that they're not handling the income that they're receiving right now so well. Because if you look historically, the tax revenue is extremely high. It's been going up every year, but spending is literally out of control, and I think that's what we need to get a handle on more than anything else is spending as opposed to the tax situation. Because if you're in a down economy, and raising taxes is just going to cripple it even more.
So is it a tax problem or a spending problem?
Well, that's a very legitimate point of view, that if you want the low taxes, you really have to rein in the spending. And the caller is absolutely right. We've actually we've lowered taxes and we have continued spending on our merry way. So if that's your, the way you view government and the way you think about what the government should do, that's a perfectly legitimate point of view. I think the fly in the ointment is even though the revenues have been rising to the federal treasury, as the caller points out. They don't cover the amount of the tax cuts. All of the experts who've kind of looked at this, if you make a certain kind of tax cut, revenues do rise, but it doesn't cover that whole amount. So we have to be realistic about that. I think that there is a very complex issue here because most of the spending are on things that most Americans are supporting. Medicare, Social Security, and defense, which has been strongly supported since 2001 because we felt we needed to invest there, and interest on the debt. So, we have to talk frankly about where we're going to get these cuts. There are all the other things there, and they should be targets as well. But I think we need to, you can't just say cut spending. We have to, get down to the nitty-gritty and do it. And for people who really want government to do these things and really feel it's strongly that government has a role in these various programs and they can make life better for the American people, then we have to come up to the plate and raise the taxes to match the spending.
Well, just to show that I'm not more or less motivated by self-interest than the next person, I'm saying we should take public broadcasting off the table if we're talking about cuts. But, okay.
It's interesting what you say because, I think all of us like to think, well, gee, there's something to be cut that nobody cares about. And lots of people care about public broadcasting, of course.
Well,
but
there's
a constituency for everything that the government does. One of the what makes it hard.
One of the things you have in your book is you have this great it almost looks like a spreadsheet that goes on for several pages and talks about the different programs there are and who their constituency is and whether how easy it would be to cut them. And when you read that, you just look and say, well, man, where are we going to go? Because every place you look, well, nope, can't cut that because,
Well, that's the key thing. Everything in the federal budget is important to somebody. And at the bottom line, these are value judgments in question. And I think one of our problems as a nation, one of the fundamental problems, is that we don't really talk about government in terms of what we want it to do and how much we're willing to pay to do it. And the fact that we consistently run deficits is an expression of that. We have this unresolved issue about how much government we want, and rather than deal with it, we just borrow the money to cover it. And we're reaching the point where we're not going to be able to delay that conversation much longer.
Well, I want to talk about that borrowing in just a moment, but we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. Here's the name of the book, Where Does the Money Go? Your guided tour to the federal budget crisis. It's published by Collins. And we're talking with the authors, Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson. We'll continue that conversation, and you can join us as well at 800-642-1234 and 263-1890. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:22. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on the Ideas Network. After one on Talk of the Nation, paying down credit debt. Well, that kind of goes with this program we have on right now. We're talking with the authors of the book, Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. And we have the authors of that book joining us by phone, Scott Biddle, who is the executive editor of Public Agenda Online, and Gene Johnson, who's executive vice president and founder of Public Agenda Online. So the question is, I guess we've borrowed a lot of money, and we've got to pay it back. Who holds all the notes?
Well, this is basically anyone who buys a treasury bond is part of the national debt, is financing the federal deficits. And one of the big concerns, of course, is that a quarter of our $9 trillion debt is held by foreign countries, the big three being Japan, China, and Great Britain. Nobody's much worried about Japan and Great Britain, but of course China is a country whose strategic interests don't necessarily line up with ours. And there's serious questions about whether this means they have leverage on us or whether this means we don't have any leverage on them or both.
There's been a lot of talk about a lot of things, but there's been a lot of talk about these bonds, and some people are saying, well, it's certainly not in the best interests of the Chinese to call in or to sell off these bonds. And yet I read comments from economists and finance ministers within the Chinese government saying, you know what, we really ought to dump these things because interest rates are low and we're not making enough money on them, and so why don't we get rid of them?
This is the dilemma from the Chinese point of view. They have been putting their money into treasury bonds because it's always been the safest of safe investments. Right now, they're exporting a lot more than they're importing. They've got a lot of cash. They need to park it somewhere. The problem is, of course, you can make more money elsewhere. And the other problem from their perspective, I'm sure that in Beijing, they occasionally think about using this debt to yank our chain over one thing or another. But the problem is, if they started dumping the bonds, that would not just really roil the American economy, but the world economy. And China does need stable world markets for its own goods. So it's kind of a mixed thing from China's point of view. The question would be, would there ever be a situation politically where China would be willing to sacrifice economically to get what it wants?
You know, I think that the situation with the debt, and you raised the point earlier about, you know, how do we get this way? You know, so far, it's been a kind of a so far, so good scenario. People still want treasury bonds. They're considered to be a good investment. Hopefully that will keep on going, and we won't have any of the kind of turmoil in the world that would set that up. So far we've been able to afford the interest payments, but the problem is that even on the interest payments, right now we are actually spending more on interest payments than we're spending on the war in Iraq, and most Americans don't realize that. We have a lot of conversations about the money we're spending on Iraq and what we could do with it, and how we're going to afford it in the future, and we're not talking about what we're spending on the interest. And the second is that even if we were to balance the budget and kind of stay with the status quo, we have these huge obligations. When the 78 million baby boomers who have been paying into Social Security and Medicare, and now they're going to start drawing out. And we have to figure out how to make those programs sustainable for the people who need them and for the workers who are paying for them.
Well, that's certainly the elephant in the room, and it's the thing that no one seems to want to talk about, and you get varying things saying, well, we don't have a problem with Social Security right now. There's plenty of money, and we don't have to deal with this until 2050. And then you have others who say, well, the time to deal with this was really 10 years ago, and now no matter what we do, we're basically up the proverbial creek without the proverbial paddle. And sometimes it gets to be a little bit difficult to know who to believe. What is the what's the real situation from your point of view with Social Security and Medicare?
Well, first off, the key thing that I think goes past a lot of people is that we tend to talk about Social Security more, but the fact is Medicare is in far more trouble. Medicare has a trust fund like Social Security does, but that's going to run out of money in 2019, which is not that far off. And the problem with Medicare is that it has two things going on. One is the aging of the baby boomers, which also is a problem for Social Security, but it also has healthcare inflation. Healthcare costs keep clipping along at an increase of 6 or 7% a year consistently. When you put that together with the retirement of the baby boomers, you end up with a huge problem. If you look at that GAO estimate of our future liabilities, the $50 trillion of liabilities ahead, $32 trillion is Medicare. So that gives you a sense of the scope of the problem. By contrast, Social Security is relatively manageable because it's basically about how many people are paying in versus how many people are taking out. Also, the trust fund for Social Security will be around much longer. The worst-case scenario, if we do nothing in 2041, is basically the Social Security will only be able to pay 75% of the promised benefits.
Well, how much of that Social Security trust fund is in cash, and how much of it is actually just IOUs?
They're in bonds, which you can treat as an IOU. The government uses the money, the surplus from Social Security, for its regular budget, and it gives the trust fund treasury bonds.
So there are really two problems with Social Security. One is that the trust fund, has a projection of running out at a certain point. But the other is that there are all these treasury bonds in it. So now while the American government is not going to default on treasury bonds, that puts a huge pressure on the government itself because they've been using that money for other purposes. So, this is when you get into this scenario of every dollar that comes into taxes, more and more are going to be going just for Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. You get to this point where you really have no money left over for everything else. And I think the other point that is so important for Social Security, based on the research we've done, there are lots of changes that probably would be acceptable to most Americans if we can kind of get the political will to look at it. But if you're going to change the program, you really want to do it while most of the 78 million baby boomers are still working, so that if we're going to pay more taxes, we can pay for ourselves and kind of, beef up the program. And so that if we're going to cut back on benefits or trim them in certain ways, we have time to plan. You don't want to surprise people 15, 20, 25 years down the road when people are elderly and fragile, and suddenly you're either going to pull the rug out from under them financially, or you're going to put horrendous tax burdens on working people with families. We don't have to get to that point if we start now.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Art in Appleton. Art, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have long wondered what the difference in our lifestyles might be if the Social Security Fund had been managed properly in the first place and had never been allowed to be become a part of the general fund, which I think took place back in the 60s. And I look at what the amount of difference would mean per person who contributed to that, and say, for instance, that just a very conservative 5% rate of return that each person could have in their Social Security fund easily today in almost any kind of an investment. And I look at the fact that the government says no, we shouldn't be allowed to do that because we're not we're not capable, we don't understand enough to do that, and yet they're generating a whopping 5% rate of return on our money. But I think of the differences that it might make had that fund been left alone as it should have been. And if you look at an elderly person and the cost of living that they're going to face in retirement, in terms of medications, in terms of housing, in terms of food costs and things. And people could actually, the ripple effect of that could be, so far-reaching, to the point where you might even have people, if they had confidence in the system, saying, maybe some moms could afford to stay home for a few years with their kids in their formative years if they wanted to. But nobody believes anymore that anything is there. But the problem that we have is that immediately the government turns around and they want to blame all the corporations for taking all these tax breaks and all the giving, everything that's given away to the corporations that actually produce something for what they get. But the bottom line is that the government is pointing one finger outward and the other four should be pointing backward, and we should be four times as outraged at what our government is doing to us because it's far worse than what any corporations are doing. And I'll take any comments or responses you have off the air.
All right, thanks for that call, Art.
Well, I think one of the things we wrote this book as kind of a voter's self-defense manual, because people are going to be hearing a lot from politicians this year and promised a lot from politicians this year. And we're great believers in the political philosophy of Homer Simpson, who said it takes two to lie, one to lie and one to listen. And I think the fundamental solution here is for the American people to think about the math when politicians promise them things. If they promise them tax cuts without spending cuts, if they promise them, programs without revenue, if they talk about shuffling around money like it's just some bookkeeping thing and it doesn't matter, and they have to get up on their hind legs and question this. And, that's the fundamental thing.
I think there are a couple of issues with Social Security that it helps to think about. One is it was always set up, rightly or wrongly, as a pay-as-you-go system. That is, the taxes that are collected from workers are paying the Social Security benefits of people who are retired. And if it hadn't been set up that way, then, FDR, back in the day, they would have had to wait 25 years or so to be able to give anybody any money, and they didn't want to do that. They wanted to be able to direct money at retired people right away. So there is that issue. This issue of borrowing from the trust fund, because you've had so many more people working and paying in for so many years, there have been proposals, for many years now to have a lockbox and to save that money. And, it takes the two to tango issue here. Americans weren't all that interested in doing anything about it. So, we've made certain decisions along the way, and we've allowed our government to do things along the way. I think the one issue with this idea of investing the money or to let people invest it themselves is, there are two issues. One is the kind of system we want, but the second is there are transition costs. Because we're using the money to pay people who are retired now, if we let people invest the money instead and put it into a 401k, we have to come up with the money someplace else to pay people who are retired, because we're not going to just cut people off without a dime.
Well, Social Security was never meant to be a retirement plan per se, like the pension you get from where you used to get from work.
Exactly. It was designed in a different way. I think most of the people who propose some sort of an investment account, and Alan Greenspan is somebody who has proposed this, they propose doing it very, very very gradually. So it's a little bit by bit by bit by bit, and maybe, you know, 25 years out, 30 years out, you would have a very different system. But to do it suddenly right away would really, you know, there's a big hole to be filled.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Laura in Madison. Laura, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Social Security. I keep hearing Social Security. Is that the only thing in the budget? Seems to me defense. Would you please compare defense spending with Social Security? And why don't we have pensions anymore? It seems like maybe they're reneging on their promise to their employees.
Well, one of the things that surprises people is that defense and Social Security are actually very comparable parts of the budget pie. Social Security, they're both about 20% of the federal budget. Social Security is actually slightly larger. There are two big differences there, of course. One is that defense, while there's lots of pressure to keep spending the way we spend on defense, it is something that's reviewed every year, and decisions are made every year. And you can make choices about missions, whether we need the defense we've got, whether we can cut back. Social Security and Medicare and, to some extent, Medicaid all kind of run on autopilot. They're driven by formulas, and Congress doesn't actually review them every year. They just kind of take them as a given. Oh, the formula says we have to spend X on Social Security. So they operate in different ways. You can certainly set any set of priorities for the federal budget you want, so long as you step back and say, okay, this is what you want. You can say less defense. You can say more defense. But, again, these programs operate in different ways, and that's why people, I think, in Washington anyway, think of them differently.
You know, I think the caller brings up an important point, though, and that is if we're going to try to get our spending in line and try to be more adult about the way the country uses its money, you know, we do have to look at everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we want to look at what we're spending on defense. I mean, certainly there are concerns about wastefulness and efficiency. There are a lot of questions about how that money is being used and how it's being accounted for. Social Security, likewise. I mean, we need to take a look at that, and if you care about Social Security, you need to support taking a look at it. So everything really should be on the table. And, I think one of the points that we make in the book, where we don't really recommend solutions, we really try to lay out the problem and say, you know, there are all these different things that could be done to address it. Probably not any one of us is going to get our way. All of us may have a set of things we want, and we might do our little worksheet in our own way, but there's going to have to be some give and take to get this done. This is a democracy. People view the budget differently, and there's just going to have to be some compromise.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Tim in Verona. Tim, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. Being a deficit hawk for more years than I care to remember, I'm definitely going to buy your book. And what I do is I study the federal receipts and outlays every year. And just to give you an example, from 2006, you were mentioning 20% of our outlays go to the Defense Department. It's amazing to me that what we did is in 2006, our interest on the national debt was $403 billion, and our defense budget was $495 billion. I predict that if we keep going the way that we're going, our largest outlay is going to be the interest on the national debt. It's just amazing. To put that in a weekly term, FY 2007, our interest on the national debt grew to $430 billion. If you divide that out by 52, that's greater than $8.25 billion a week. Because what you did is you made the comparison to Iraq and the war at $9 billion a month. we're almost paying that a week on the national debt.
Thanks for that call, Tim. I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, the projections, the government's own auditors project that, again, if nothing is done, interest on the debt and Medicare and Social Security would eventually take up the entire budget. I think this is another thing. The whole question of interest on the debt is another one of these parts of the federal budget that is really unexamined, and maybe it should be. I mean, nobody really says, when we talk about putting things on the table, you know, we never look at the whole pie. There are all these things that we take as untouchable. And, of course, we have to pay the interest on the debt for the banks to keep loaning us money. We control that by getting the overall budget under control.
You know, I think what really confuses a lot of Americans is just this concept of this routine deficit spending. This is a very wealthy country. And, you know, maybe right now we're handling the interest on the debt. But why is it that we've gotten into this pattern as if it doesn't matter? And, you know, I think, unfortunately, there's certainly times when it's legitimate for the country to go into debt. I mean, we did in World War II, you know, certainly there may be moments when you need to do that. But as a routine matter, and, you know, to do it without much discussion about it, just to kind of slide over because it's the easier path, you know, really just seems that we have to stop that. And the American people have to really wake up and get as mad about this with their elected officials as they, you know, they currently get about anybody who suggests touching Social Security. You know, we've got sort of the wrong standards when we look at our elected officials, and we should be getting mad about this debt and the interest and not addressing these financial issues.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. The name of the book is Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis. And my guests are Scott Biddle, who is the executive director, or excuse me, executive editor of Public Agenda Online, and Gene Johnson, who is executive vice president and founder of Public Agenda Online. They join me by phone, and you can too at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Kathleen Dunn is in next hour, and after nine, she'll be talking with award-winning foreign correspondent Martin Fletcher about his most memorable reporting and what's happening in the world today. That's coming up after nine here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the book, Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour of the Federal Budget Crisis, and it's published by Collins. We have the authors of the book with us by phone, executive editor of Public Agenda Online, Scott Biddle, and Gene Johnson, executive vice president of Public Agenda Online. And one of the things that, you point out a lot of things in the book, and one of the things I think I could summarize it by saying that there isn't any one magic bullet that's going to make these budget problems go away. I mean, some people like to say, okay, if it wasn't for this war in Iraq, we wouldn't have a deficit. Or, you know, if we just rolled back the Bush tax cuts, we wouldn't have this problem. Or if we didn't, if we made the corporations pay what they should pay for their fair share in taxes, again, we wouldn't have the problem. Or if politicians would stop giving earmarks, we wouldn't have the problem. None of those things by itself is going to solve this problem. Would that be a fair assessment?
I think it is a fair assessment, and I think one of the things that we point out in the book is that, you know, it took us years to get ourselves into this pickle, and it's going to take us years to get out of it. And, you know, we're going to have to sort of have a new frame of mind about taxes and spending and certainly take a hard look at these entitlement programs if we want them to do what most Americans expect them to do. And, you know, I think there are a lot of sort of misperceptions or, you know, most of us don't pay that much attention to the budget. So, you know, we were surprised ourselves in how some of these numbers shake out when you really take a look at them.
Let's take a call from Paul in Slinger. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Just one quick thing, and that is, understand that the rate that a corporation pays, if it's low, the earnings go out in dividends to the stockholders, and then they will pay their taxes on it. So it's just bring that point. But could you create, or I think one could create some scenarios going out the next decade, where, in fact, the revenue stream to pay taxes in this country would be such that perhaps a condition could be developed where we would default, the federal government would default on these instruments or notes. And I think in our history that has happened. We're in the 17th, 18th century, I think we defaulted on some European nations or citizens that bought our bonds. The question is, can you create various scenarios and what would actually happen if the United States with this $9 trillion debt defaulted? What happens? What happens to the citizens that own bonds? Does the government just inflate the dollar, devalue the dollar, rather? And just explain that to me.
Well, there are a number of things that could happen. There are one of the problems is, since we are the world's largest economy, it's actually very hard to draw exact parallels, because most of the modern loan defaults occur in countries that are much, much smaller, and, you know, things like the International Monetary Fund is involved. The best recent example, however, is Argentina. Argentina got in over its head in the early, about seven, 8 years ago. It defaulted on its borrowing. It was the largest default in history. And they had a terrible recession, where 50% of the population was in poverty. Unemployment was at like 25%. They had riots in the streets. Martial law was declared. Bank assets were frozen. Two or maybe three presidents were forced from office. It was tough. And the international investors eventually, you know, the IMF and so on, got like 35 cents on the dollar. Now, again, because we are the world's largest economy, it wouldn't necessarily go down like that here. But defaulting on the bonds would be an earthquake in world economics. And you would expect very serious, basically a very serious recession if the government did that.
Well, you know, and I think we're hoping, and I think there's a lot of reason to believe that the government would not let it go that far.
Exactly.
But what is a possibility, and is not an unlikely possibility, is that there begins to be a lot of pressure, and that try to make the bonds more attractive, we have to raise interest rates. And, you know, a lot of Americans, you know, you say interest rates go up, and you think of it primarily as, oh, gee, a mortgage is going to be more expensive, so that if you're not in the market for a home, maybe it doesn't really affect you. But in fact, you know, high interest rates really cut down business investment. You know, that leads to layoff. That leads to a lack of creation of new jobs. It just really, you know, freezes up the economy and can just really put the economy into a, you know, very slow growth, kind of balky mode. And then, of course, it would be very likely that would affect the stock market. So as a citizen, you would be facing high interest rates, lots of layoffs. Your investments, if you had them, might be taking a tumble. The government wouldn't be able to provide the services you expect and have wanted. And, probably they're raising taxes as well to try to make ends meet. So it's a really an awful scenario for the average person. This is not some technical issue in Washington. It really can affect us in our daily lives.
Well, I have a dilemma now. I want to take more calls, but more importantly, I want to get to something in your book that I think we absolutely have to cover before the end of the hour, and that is, toward the end, you talk about six realities that we need to face, six things we need to do in order to move forward in something sustainable. And so why don't we talk about that right now, and then we'll see how many calls we can squeeze in before the top of the hour.
One of the realities that we point out is this waste, fraud, and abuse. And everybody wants to address waste, fraud, and abuse, and I think there's a very compelling reason to do that. But we have to stop pinning our hopes to that. So one of our realities is we need to address waste, fraud, and abuse in government, and then we need to move on, because we cannot cure this problem just by squeezing out the excess in these programs.
I think one of the other realities is that we have a short-term problem and a long-term problem. and we have to work on both of them. The short-term problem is the federal deficit, the fact that we, you know, every year we spend more than we take in, and that's about decisions about the year-to-year budget. And then we have the long-term problem, which is looking at Social Security and Medicare. And this requires us, you know, to start thinking about things like long-term benefits, long-term taxes, and particularly health care costs, because the fact that health care costs are going, you know, are rising throughout the economy is affecting the government the same way it is everyone else.
You know, the other reality is we absolutely need to start now. I mean, you hear these numbers like 2040, and you think, oh, gosh, we don't have to worry about that. But all of the choices that are in this problem are so much easier financially and politically if we start now and we do them gradually, give everybody time to adjust and you know, do what they need to do, than to postpone them and have to do it in a panic later on, which would be awful.
And we also have to hold politicians accountable on this. We simply cannot let politicians get away this election year with behaving like this problem doesn't exist, because it does. And everybody in Washington knows it. Not that many people outside of Washington know it, but it's going to shape everything we do going forward.
You know, the other thing we point out, and I mentioned it earlier, is we can all think about what we individually want, but we need to think about what we can live with, because we're going to have to, as Americans, come to some agreement to address this, and that probably means, you know, most of us are not going to get our wish list on how this is going to be solved. We're going to have to do a little give and take.
And as Gene said earlier, this is also about state of mind. You have to think of it like dieting, where you have to stay on a regimen, and you've got to stick to it, and you've got to say, okay, I'm going to make tough decisions even though I don't like it.
Well, so is there a light at the end of the tunnel? And please tell me it's not a train.
Absolutely. This problem is completely fixable. And we're very optimistic, because when Public Agenda has done research on this, when we've had focus groups and so on this problem, it's true, this is not the first thing on people's mind, but it's also true that with very little information, people get it. They very quickly get into the mindset of, we have to do something about this. They're willing to compromise. They're willing to be bipartisan about it. They're willing to consider things, things that politicians are afraid to suggest to them, even spending cuts, even tax increases.
Let's try and get some phone calls in before the top of the hour. And Jim in Oshkosh has been on hold. Jim, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Please talk about the multiplier effect of government spending on the private sector. It is my sense that many in the private sector like government spending. Contracts are let, money is spent out there. Please talk about that.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, one of the things we were talking about spending is that the spending has a lot of different constituency, and the constituencies are not just individual citizens. I mean, we have companies that depend on the government contracts, as you point out, and certainly on the other side of it, we have all these constituencies, the tax code in certain ways that are beneficial to them. So, you know, one of the issues that we take up in the book is the power of lobbying, and the fact that there are representatives of, there can be corporate interests, there are individual interests, there are different groups in society, 30-some thousand of them, and, you know, they are not lobbying to balance the budget. They're lobbying for a tax cut that benefits them or spending that benefits them, and this is something we're going to have to curtail.
Okay, let's go to, D in Sheboygan. D, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Commenting on where does the money go, I would like to ask a question. If the people who run the Medicare program are so worried about running out of funds, why do they continue to expand the services through the program? They're even providing electric wheelchairs, and they talk about the diabetic drugs that get mailed right to the home. These services are farmed out to Liberty Company, which advertises incessantly about what Medicare will provide. And the only requirements are that people be 65 and have both A and B Medicare. They boast that all these services are available without any other charges, and that 30 million people have availed themselves of these services through Medicare. These services were never originally a part of the original program, and they shouldn't be now, and this advertising on TV must be horribly expensive.
Well, we're almost
advertised constantly.
We're almost out of time, so I want to make sure we give our guests a chance to respond to your comments. Thanks so much, Dee, for that call.
Well, that's a wonderful point, because I think that there is going to have to be a hard look at Medicare spending in many different areas. And, you know, this the rate that it's increases, they absolutely are going to have to take a look at this issue and many others. It's got to be on the agenda of the next president and the next Congress.
So let's kind of try to get a summary here of kind of where we've been. Spending on the war isn't the only cause of the deficit. Tax cuts don't pay for themselves. What else have we learned here?
Well, that we have a short-term and a long-term problem, and when we think about our votes in the fall, you know, whether it's the president or Congress, we need to start thinking about what they're promising and how they're going to pay for it, and we need to look for people who are going to tackle these long-term problems with Social Security and Medicare to protect ourselves.
And it's totally solvable, and I think that is one, the most important point. This could be a disaster, but there's no reason it has to be.
And your website is www.publicagenda.org. And can people get more information about these issues on your website?
Absolutely, and a number of other issues as well. We cover background on more than 20 different public policy issues. We also have a separate site just on the federal budget called facingup.org.
Thank you so much for joining me this hour. It's been very educational.
Thanks for having us.
The name of the book is Where Does the Money Go? Your Guided Tour to the Federal Budget Crisis, written by Scott Biddle and Gene Johnson, and published by Collins. And again, their website is www.publicagenda.org. This program was produced by Carmen Jackson, with on-air production by Leo Duran. If you'd like a copy of it, it's available at the radio store. Call 800-747-7444 and ask for program 34C, as in crisis. Or if you want to listen to it again, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to it in real time. Or if you're a member of Wisconsin Public Radio, you can download it. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.